Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the second event of this special 15th anniversary season of the Panetta Institute Lecture Series. This year, we're discussing the many changes that have impacted our nation and our globe in this still new century. Our goal in these discussions is to understand the revolutions occurring in our times so that we can consider the actions that we must take to prepare for the future. Tonight, we turn the discussion to the subject of our economy. With each release of new economic indicators, there is growing sense that the economy is slowly working towards a recovery. But after such a long period of decline, and with so many fiscal challenges still looming, it's difficult to believe that we finally turned the corner. Employment figures have shown modest improvement, but there are still far too many Americans out of work. Further, prolonged unemployment raises serious questions about the readiness and skill of our labor force. American homeowners are also still struggling with foreclosures. Falling property values and failing confidence in both the banking industry and government oversight agencies continue to weaken the housing market. As we emerge from the recession, have we learned the painful lessons from this financial crisis? Are families learning to live within their means and save for the future? Can our education system prepare our youth for the next generation of jobs in this emerging global economy? Have we found the right balance between regulation and innovation of the free market? And most importantly, can our leaders achieve the essential compromises necessary to reducing our record deficits and our debt? Last year, we heard from the two chairs of the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. They had just released their recommendations and were hopeful that some of their recommendations would be embraced. Unfortunately, there's been no movement on these recommendations. We've seen another bipartisan committee try but fail to find consensus on this vital issue. Our nation's fiscal health is trapped by partisan politics, and by gridlock. The failure of the supercommittee and the mandatory sequester trigger join other budgetary crises that have undermined confidence in our ability to govern. With the rise of nations like China and India and the instability of the euro, the question is whether America can make the decisions essential to securing a prosperous future for our nation. Tonight, we'll discuss this vital issue with two longtime friends. Both are known for their frankness and dedication in pursuing a new, prudent economic course for the country. Leon worked with them when he was in Congress and later in the White House. From globalization and the developing labor force to the deficit and the solvency of entitlement programs, these two speakers know every aspect of our complex economic systems and the politics that are associated with it. In a word, they provide the long and short view of these critical issues. And for those of you who aren't laughing, you'll see. Our first guest is one of the nation's leading thinkers about business and the economy. He has written more than 200 articles and 14 books on the global economy and the changing nature of work. He served as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration and was a member of President Obama's economic transition team. Leon worked with him at the White House and considers him one of the most articulate and brilliant economists in America. He's a dear friend and colleague. Please welcome Robert Reich. Our second guest is one of our most popular returning speakers. A pioneer from the cowboy state of Wyoming, his brass tacks approach to complicated fiscal issues offers an important and honest voice to any economic discussion. First elected to the Senate in 1978, he went on to serve three terms and was assistant majority leader from 1984 to 1994. Subsequent to his retirement from government, he taught at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and served with Leon on the bipartisan Iraq Study Group. In 2010, President Obama selected him to serve as co-chair of the bipartisan National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. He, too, is a great friend and colleague of ours. Please welcome Senator Alan Simpson.
Oh, I was just looking at how do you do?
What you make it?
Good too.
Thank you. And finally, returning this year to guide the discussion is a noted journalist and expert on the financial markets. A 22-year veteran of business television, he is known for his sharp perspective on business and the economy and presently serves as a contributor for CNBC. Please join me in welcoming our moderator for this evening, Ron Insana.
Thank you. Thank you. Gentlemen. Good evening, everyone. Thank you. It is a joy to be back here in Monterey, California. It certainly beats New Jersey, as you all know by now. This is my third time here. I keep coming back for this very reason. It is also an honor to be part of the Panetta Lecture Series, something I've drawn great pleasure from over the last several years. Tonight, of course, we're going to explore the current state of the U.S. economy, a subject I talk about every day virtually on CNBC or in other venues. And we are continuing, as you know, to watch key indicators with respect to employment, consumer spending, and the like. All of these have been variables which at times this year have looked strong and most recently have looked a little bit weaker than expected and lead to a variety of questions about where we sit currently. So with that, what we really want to know is what lies ahead. And as you heard this evening, we have with us two rather august panelists, Bob Reich and Senator Simpson as well. And gentlemen, we've done this many times over the past many years, and we've gone through a variety of cycles together. And Bob, when you take a look at this particular moment in history, which is in some ways unique, we've gone through an extraordinary couple of years. It does appear that we may be out of recession. And before I ask you, let me ask the audience very quickly. How many of you think we're in a blistering, robust economic recovery? How many of you think we're still in recession? Wow. So, Bob, we asked that question of our students today. The preponderance of those individuals said we are still in recession. We get the same response this evening. And we're actually in recovery. No one knows it.
We are in a recovery. And the reason nobody knows it, Ron, is because very few people feel it. And only about 10% of our population really is in a recovery. That is, their incomes are going up and their stock market portfolio is going up. About 90% of Americans, their job is still precarious, their wages are flat, their benefits are going down, and they don't feel like this is a recovery. Their major asset is not their stock portfolio, it's their home. And home values still have not bottomed out. They're close to the bottom. Let me just say what we can get into, and we will get into what we do about all of this, but I want to just point out that I am so pleased to be here with my dear friend Alan K. Simpson. We see eye to eye on nothing. And I keep thinking either I'm going to grow or Al is going to shrink or something's going to happen. And we never see eye to eye. But
actually, if I were your child, I would be just the right size. I don't know. Just a thought.
That's a disgusting thought. Anyway, back to the economy. I think that we are officially in a recovery. It's one of the most anemic recoveries on record, and I think it is, unfortunately, very fragile still.
Senator, would you agree with that? Or you know, in Washington right now, it's hard to tell whether you're in recovery or recession because this, of late, has been the Full Employment Act for lawyers and lobbyists, so it's pretty busy down there, not so much necessarily in other parts of the country. How would you characterize the current state of the economy?
Well, Erskine and I felt that we should be prepared in our report to reflect upon the fact that a fragile recovery was out there. And I think it is out there, fragile indeed. But we, in our report, we never put teeth in the shark until 2013 so that we wouldn't hinder whatever recovery might be out there until 2013, because the economists argue that you can't do this and you're going to hurt things and it's not going to juice things up, it's going to hinder things, and we need more stimulus, and where are you going to get the money to do that? And if you do it, you're going to get defeated at the next election. They're proving that to some of these guys. So it's the toughest one we've ever faced, and it'll all come to a cliff before December 31st.
Let me ask you about that, Senator, the so-called fiscal cliff. Alan Blinder has written about this, the former vice chair of the Federal Reserve, that on January 1st or December 31st of this year, whichever date you used to characterize it, we will suddenly see $530 billion in tax cuts disappear from the Bush tax cuts. We'll see the sequestration kick in that mandates spending cuts in defense and discretionary expenditures because of the deal that was cut last year as part of the budget debt ceiling negotiations. Are we going to hit that point where, at a fragile juncture in the economy, all of a sudden we hit the fiscal cliff, and not only do we not add stimulus, we subtract?
Well, that's what Bernanke has said. He said, you don't want to hit this in one day. You want to try to stretch it out. The Bush tax cuts in themselves, $3.8 trillion over 10 years. Then add the fact you got to get that payroll tax back from 4.2 to 6.2. When you do that, I suppose Grover Norquist will call that a tax increase. So you got to watch what's going to happen to you in this time between November 6th and December 31st. Going to be chaos. And I think the election is going to be chaos for various reasons. One of them, money. And Bob and I have talked about that. But let me tell you, if this, nobody remembers the story of the Pied Piper of Hamelin. Let me tell you, both parties are leading people off into the mountain where the thing will seal, and then you can just forget it.
Just so you know, for those of you who want to party with the senator afterwards, we're having a reception immediately after our conversation.
Well, I'll have a drink then, but certainly not now. Rice doesn't drink. He got drunk at Dartmouth as a student and never touched another drop. You told me that. And then you introduce Hillary and Bill. Tell them that.
I'm not going to tell them that. No, I won't.
All right, we're not going to get too far off the topic.
As an undergraduate, I had a date with Hillary, and I'm not going to tell them that either. Look, I think that 2013, next January, it is probably going to be too early to start major cuts in the budget. And I wish I didn't have to say that, but I don't see the kind of robust recovery that we needed and we assumed we'd have before 2013. So it is a potential cliff. Look, if historians had a chance right now, if we could replay history, I think that the Obama administration handled a very bad deck that was handed to them relatively well, but did two things that they shouldn't have done. Number one, the stimulus was not nearly as big as it needed to be. Easy to say that in hindsight. Some of us at the time did argue in favor of a larger stimulus. Yes. And secondly, there was no condition placed on the big banks for the second round of the bailout, such as they had to mitigate some of those mortgages. And we're still haunted by those two failures.
Now, let me ask you about Ben Bernanke, because he is central in this. He has been both Atlas and Sisyphus in this economic recovery. He's carrying the world on his shoulder, pushing a boulder up a hill all at the same time. And he's not getting help from any of his friends in Washington. Is he our only hope to prop up the economy until we can get to the point where we talk about some of these other issues.
Well, as a practical matter, he is. Yeah. But the problem is that if you rely solely on monetary policy and you don't have any fiscal policy behind you, it is a little bit like pushing on a wet noodle, because most of the middle class really doesn't have the collateral any longer in their homes to get to borrow. And the businesses are not going to borrow unless they have enough consumers to justify expanding and hiring. So, yeah, I mean, zero interest rates, effectively zero interest rates, are a help, but they're not nearly sufficient.
It won't help to just have him continuing to buy up our treasuries. That ain't going to get us anywhere either. I mean, this is happening. Yeah. And people don't understand this. I'm not a numbers guy. Erskine is the numbers guy. I do the color. And Bob Reich is a numbers guy. But let me tell you, all I do is tell people, it isn't worth talking about how we got here. It was like the Iraq study group. We just said, we don't care how we got here. What the hell do we do now? And when you tell people what a trillion is, they have no concept. We owe 16 of those babies. If you spend a buck a second from right now, you wouldn't hit a trillion for 32,500 years. If you spend a million a day since the birth of Christ, you wouldn't be at a trillion yet. And the Big Bang theory of the universe happened 13,600,000,000 years ago, and that isn't even close to a trillion, and we owe 16 of those. So when you're playing in this ring of absolute and our unfunded liabilities of America are 63 trillion. Pensions, all the rest of it, promises made that can never, ever, ever be kept, ever.
Now, Simpson is trying to scare you.
I am.
And he's doing a good job, and I'm petrified. But let me just say that the relevant issue, and it is a scary issue, is the ratio of the debt to the total economy. In other words, it doesn't matter, we could be talking about a zillion trillion, but if that's a small proportion of the total economy, which it isn't, we're okay. And I remember, I said this afternoon, in the 1950s, my dad said to me, my dad was a Republican, he hated FDR, he said, you, Bobby, and your children and your children's children, you're going to be paying down the debt of Franklin D. Roosevelt. And I was 5 years old, I didn't know what he was talking about, but I couldn't sleep because I had this nightmarish debt.
But can I just ask you, what does that cost you on an hourly basis to fix?
But here's the point, and I agree, we're not going to be able to solely grow our way out of this. But that huge FDR debt declined as a problem, not because we spent that much less. We had a Cold War, we had a Korean War, we had more Cold War, we rebuilt Japan, we built Europe, we had a national highway building program. I mean, we invested during the Eisenhower years. The real issue, the real way out was the denominator of that equation, debt GDP. The economy soared in the 1950s, so that my sons never mentioned FDR's debt. My granddaughter, she complains about a lot of things, but she never complains about FDR's debt.
Senator, I want to ask you something. We talk about indebtedness.
Enough of that. Yeah. Well, no.
People have, in my estimation, errantly been comparing us to Greece or to some European countries, which now have debt to GDP ratios in excess of 120-140%. Greece, in my estimation, is a tourist destination with a government, very much unlike the United States. They pay their people 14 months pay for 10 months work, and then they dodge their taxes. And yet people will throw this out as a comparison to the United States. Irrespective of our problems, we are not like the European countries, are we, in your estimation?
No, but as Bob said once in a lecture, the word politics comes from the Greek word poly, meaning many, and ticks, meaning blood-sucking insect. We are not Greece in any way, but let me tell you, you take the pigs, Portugal, Ireland,
Italy, Greece, and Spain.
Italy, Spain, and we are on the same trajectory of debt, deficit, and interest as all of those countries. The same trajectory. Forget the numbers. You can play the big stuff, but the trajectory is just exactly like that. Italy is the next one on the ropes. Spain is grappling right now this day. Guess what Italy owes in debt? They owe $2,600,000,000,000. We owe 16. Now, that's where we are. You're not trying to terrify anyone. You're just trying to say, wake up. You know, and then you say, well, we're hollowing out the defense budget. Get to that question. The only thing hollowing out there is your brain. Because Leon will do this if you give him time to do it as a surgeon, but if he can't possibly stand a sequester of $600 billion like that. But let me tell you, here's one. We spend $750 billion on defense in this country, and the top 14 countries on earth, including Russia and China, combined spend 540. So who is hollowing out who? What the hell are you talking about? 750 billion is us. The rest of the top 14 countries on earth, including Russia and China, combined 540. And you take a house, you take a bill to the house on defense, and they'll add 50 billion to it, and never bat an eye. And the Dems will add because none of them want to be called that they're against defense, which will be the horrible way to lose an election. So there you are.
But here, this is actually a very important point.
Don't forget.
Because I, with due respect, I want to find out something because we're good friends and we don't get partisan. But I got to ask you, Paul Ryan came out with this Republican budget just a week and a half ago. All of the Republicans in the House voted for it. And Mitt Romney called it marvelous and is all endorsing it. That calls for $4.6 trillion of tax cuts, mostly for the rich. And it restores every dollar of defense cuts that have already been passed. So it bypasses defense, restores defense, gives a big tax cut to the rich, and it will create deficits as far bigger than we have now, as far as the eye can see. And so, I don't mean that you should defend your party, your pedigree, your friends, your
look. Our proposal called for $4 trillion in reduction in 10 years. The president came out with $4 trillion in 12 years, but he wasn't specific. The reason we get eaten by rats is because we're very specific as to what we do. We're the only group, and we got 5 Democrats and 5 Republicans and 1 independent to vote for this package. That was 60% of our commission. 60% will get you anywhere in Washington. It'll beat the filibuster. There it is. But what Ryan did, to the pain of all the bleeding hearts of the world, he went for the chunk. The biggest problem in America is health care. It doesn't matter if you call it Obamacare or Elvis Presley care or I don't care care. It can't possibly work. So he goes for that. And what does he get? What's he doing to the poor seniors? What's he breaking the bedpans in the hospice? What is this monster, this Ryan monster up to? Well, I'll tell you, gang, all you need is a brain on this one. Just here it is. 2 minutes. One person in America weighs more than the other two. You got obesity, you got diabetes A and B. You got to take care of a 3-year-old with a pre-existing condition that lives to be 60. You got 10,000 people a day turning 65. You got a guy that could buy this auditorium, has a heart operation for $200,000, never even gets a bill. You got to do tort reform to lawyers, of which I am a trial lawyer. You got to do something with doctors instead of still playing this business where they do a doc fix anytime you get in and drill their teeth. They come back for a doc fix, and if you don't give them a doc fix, they won't treat people and everybody will die. You got hospitals that keep 2 sets of books instead of 1, and you got to do something with providers and guys that peddle oxygen and all the special stuff. And the scooter guy who's on the television all day says, you can't afford this, just Medicare will take care of it. Now, let me tell you, gang, that's where this system is on automatic pilot. And unless you do something with it, it will squeeze out every part of the discretionary budget, including everything you love, culture, education, the whole rest of it.
All right, so the Obama budget, not specific enough. The Ryan budget has some specifics, goes after entitlements. You and Erskine Bowles and I sat here in this very room last year talking about your plan.
Are we any closer in any way, shape, or form to getting something passed that will address the issues that both you and Bob are talking about?
I haven't shared this with Bob or anyone. We have 47 U.S. senators right now who are looking very closely at what we're doing, both parties, 24 Dems, 23 Republicans. We have 150 House members, both parties, about equal, 80, 60. And we're putting this thing in legislative language. Because the escape hatch for anybody, as it was the other day, if I could see legislative language on this moment of truth thing, I'd listen. Well, in another few weeks, we will have legislative language, book, page, and hymn number, the whole thing. You'll say to a guy, what is it you don't like? Well, I don't like this. Well, put in amendments called legislating. Make them do that. And at that point, you're going to see some movement that you will never see as long as you have these tremendous powerful interest groups who the realtors, the AARP, Grover Norquist, I mean, they're out there to kill anything. They can't stand the pain of it. But
Bob, let me get your reaction to that.
There it is.
That, to me, having done this for almost three decades, that sounds like news, what Senator Simpson just said. If that indeed is the case, and we get that far down the road where there's legislative language attached to a Simpson-Bowles-like proposal, does that breathe new life into the process, and is it a positive for the economy?
Well, I think that the Simpson-Bowles Commission is one of those rarities in America. Rarely has some commission like this attracted so much positive political rhetorical support and so little practical political support. People are, I'm sure, everybody I talk to in Washington says to me, I think it's a great, great effort. Am I going to vote for it? Forget it.
Sure.
And part of the problem is, part of the problem is Washington is now ruled by special interests. It always has been, but now the money is flowing as never before. I am chairman of a group called Common Cause. This group is 40 years old. It's dedicated to the principle of getting big money out of politics. We cannot, in this country, do anything that makes sense for the public in general as long as we have just a kind of a gusher of money taking over politics that comes from particular industries and particular groups that have very, very narrow goals. And I'm sure
But before we go into that, let me swing it back to the economy, though. If we did
this
see
is the economy.
No, I understand that. No.
Everything we want depends upon getting big money out of
correct.
Politics.
Okay, but with respect to what Senator Simpson just said, if we were to see real motion on a proposal to reduce the deficit, how important is that to consumer psychology, investor psychology, the types of things that would allow for us to keep growing, even as we face a weakening Europe, which is probably now in recession, a China that's probably slowing more dramatically than most people realize? How important would a moment like that be to us?
In the short term, that is over the next 6 months to a year, it is not important. Most people are concerned about jobs, they're concerned about wages, they're scared to death. They are underwater in terms of their mortgages. They are not talking about the budget deficit or the long-term debt. Whether we like that or not, that's the case. A consumer confidence is going up and down. It's now down. We had a terrible March employment number. A lot of that is because consumers don't have money in their pockets to turn around and buy what the economy is capable of producing. Now, after the economy gets going, when people say to themselves, well, I can breathe a sigh of relief, then if we've got this budget plan for the long term, it's going to get a lot of support. Yeah. But before then, it's just not going to be on people's minds.
Alan, Bob and I talked about this earlier. We have a slight differing point of view when it comes to the economy. In fact, let me just go out to the audience for one question. How many of you feel that the economy in Monterey is better than it's been in the last 2 years? That you can see it and feel it. Now, I've traveled around the country for last year. I did 41 dates around the country, 25 different cities. It was very hard for me to find a recession. And I didn't purposely avoid recessionary cities.
Because you avoid Cleveland and St. Louis and Toledo. Yeah.
Listen, I grew up in Buffalo. I avoid Buffalo and Cleveland for a reason. The city's hardest hit by the real estate recession, Henderson, Nevada, just outside of Las Vegas, Phoenix, Arizona, San Diego, California, Miami, Florida, All of those, Senator, were actually quite brisk, quite robust. In New York, you can go to the Shake Shack, and there are lines out the door, or you can go to the most expensive restaurant in the city, and see, not lines out the door, but people having a tough time getting in. The economy seems okay. Do you get the same sense that we're far better off than we were a couple of years ago?
Yeah, I do. I do. I see that in airports. We all fly and go places. Airports are packed. Even Easter Sunday yesterday, I mean, it's all over the country. So there's something going on. Somebody's making money, and somebody's spending money. But it's interesting to me how they complain about the savings rate in America and how dire that is and how it's going to be worse. And then they tell you the only way out of this recession is to spend. Well, if all you're supposed to do to get out of this horror story is to spend, who's going to save? So
China.
There's so many conflicts in this game. The tax code is complex, confusing. What we found, and we can get into that, we found where you can get the money to run America and you don't need to, quote, raise taxes so you can break Grover's pledge and then be cremated in your own home. You raise revenue by getting rid of tax expenditures. We were stunned from Dick Durbin to Andy Stern to Tom Coburn to find in the tax code $1,100 billion worth of tax expenditures, which are nothing more than tax earmarks, which are nothing more than spending in the tax code. And if you went in and ripped those, so we said, tear them all out. There are over 180 of them. Use $100 billion to reduce the debt. Take the other trillion and give the people what they've been howling about for years. Give them a new tax rate, which is broaden the base, lower the rates, get spending out of the code. And we said, with that trillion, we say, okay, here's a deal for you. 0 to 70 grand, you pay 8%. From 70 grand to 210, you pay 14. Everything over that, pay 23. Take the corporate rate to 26 from 36 and go to a territorial system so you don't tax it twice on the way in and out. And that's what you could do. Now, by that, you're going to get rid of the, quote, home mortgage interest deduction, $1 million in interest. How many people get that baby? You're trying to talk about the little guy day and night. Well, what the hell is $1 trillion for mortgage deduction? We take it to 500,000, and then we said, give you a 12.5% non-refundable tax credit for anything other than that, which helps the little guy. I almost gag to hear everybody talking about the little guy. And when the markets react here and kick our butt down the road and inflation goes up and interest rates goes up, the guy who gets hurt the most is the little guy. That's the way, that's the hook we're in right now.
Let me talk about the little guy.
You saved me from having to ask.
There are three fundamental facts when it comes to taxes and also what we need to do as a country. Fact number one is that we have not had this much concentrated income and wealth at the very top in 80 years. Fact number two is that the top, I'm talking about the top 1%, has not faced a lower marginal tax rate since 1980. And fact number three is that given all the budget deficit we really do have to worry about, we also have got to make investments in education, in early childhood education, in public higher education, in infrastructure, roads, bridges, and also basic R&D. This made our nation competitive and productive, and if we continue to disinvest like we have been, we're going to be in terrible trouble. Now put all those together, and what do you come up with? Well, it seems to me we may not like it, we've got to raise taxes on the people who are at the top. This is not rocket science. This is not a matter of occupier movement. This is not a matter of something that is radical. Just go back to the tax code we had for four decades, from the 1940s through the 1970s. We had a faster rate of economic growth We had, we invested like mad in education infrastructure.
I want to ask you more about the economy and where it's standing now. But with respect to that point,
one other item about fact number one.
Yeah.
1% of the American individuals pay 35% of the income tax. So let's get that little baby thrown out into the
tax. No, but wait a minute. But the baby has bring the baby back because that does not include Social Security taxes, sales taxes, property taxes.
50% pay any income tax.
But Al, that's the income tax.
We got a yeah here somewhere.
Capital gains taxes. I mean,
Bob, let me just ask.
I don't want to be partisan.
No. I'm not sure.
But you've got somebody running for president on the Republican ticket. I think he's probably going to be the candidate, who has been earning $20 million a year and paying 13.9% tax. Now, this is a time when we've got schools that are basically losing teachers. We can't even afford the Cal State system. We've got the federal government is reducing Pell Grants for needy students. We're cutting, in Paul Ryan's budget, he wants to cut food stamps.
What?
Yes. Child nutrition.
Bob.
Let me just ask you a question.
The marginal tax rates that you talked about from 1940 to 1980, the top marginal tax rates were not paid by anyone. No one paid them.
Yes,
there were plenty of loopholes and deductions and ways around it from 1986.
But the effective tax rate, let's go to the 50s. Okay. Nobody accused Dwight Eisenhower, I don't think, of being a socialist. Now, the official top marginal tax rate was 91%.
Yes.
The effective tax rate was 56%. That is so much higher than anybody is considering now.
But that was a one-off event. In the post-World War II environment, where we rebuilt the productive capacity of Europe and Japan and ourselves, that's not a series of events that will likely play out again. I mean, that overshadowed everything. Tax rates, it overshadowed any other economic variable that we had. We had a baby boom going on. We had all sorts of things. Household formation was on par with nothing we'd ever seen before. So tax rates were not the sole variable during that period, right?
It wasn't the sole variable. And I'm not suggesting it's the sole answer now by any stretch of the imagination. I'm just saying that we cannot, given where we are, how much disinvestment we've made publicly, and also the long-term budget deficit crisis, we can't simply say we're going to reduce everybody's taxes to 23% and try, hopefully, as Paul Ryan is doing, to close the tax loopholes, because the mortgage interest deduction, try to close the mortgage interest deduction. You might as well assassinate yourself.
Of course, but we said in our 67-page report, just get it, read it, it's in English, it talks about words like going broke and shared sacrifice. There's been no shared sacrifice in this country since World War II. We're at the lowest revenue coming in since the Korean War, 15% of GDP. But if you use figures like this all day long and use phrases like GDP or growth rate, people are asleep. They're not listening to that. You don't need PowerPoints. You don't need, all sorts of graphs. Just know that if you spend a buck and borrow 41 cents, you got to be stupid. And every day, today, your country borrowed $3.6 billion bucks. And they'll borrow $3.6 billion bucks tomorrow and every day the rest of the year. That's what we do. And that's the course we're on. And if you took every bit of revenue that came in last year, every shred of revenue from every source, tariffs, whatever you want to call it, that took care of Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security solvency, and we went then and borrowed every penny to run defense, homeland security, education, culture, every other discretionary part of the budget. We borrowed that, and that's what we do every day. That is totally unsustainable. If we do nothing and continue this course in the year 2012, 2020, the interest will be $1 trillion bucks a year, which will be not very helpful for infrastructure or education or CSU or anything, but it sure as hell will help India in their education and China in their education. Half of this debt is privately owned. The other half is publicly owned, and China owns half of that.
All right. Let's
shape up.
I want to agree. I want to
sure
agree.
Do?
I do want to
about
agree.
What?
I don't know. No, I think the biggest crisis in terms of the upcoming deficit is health care. You mentioned this.
That's right.
And the real problem is you've got 76 million baby boomers who are all going to be retiring over the next 25 years.
Yep.
And all of their bodies are going to be corroding simultaneously. And you've got healthcare expenditures going like this. And we have the most inefficient healthcare system in the entire world. It is the only healthcare system designed to avoid sick people. It really is. And there's nothing preventive about it. Here's something I learned from Alan Simpson. My father began walking 5 miles a day when he was 65 years old. Today, he's 98 years old. And we have no idea where he is. I learned that from you. Talk about prevention. No, we know exactly where he is. But we don't have, in our healthcare system, we do not have a system of preventive care. And that is one of the major problems facing us in the future. So I want to agree. I think healthcare is the biggest, $1,000 billion problem.
Let me ask a flip side question about the economy, because we are trying to focus on some of that as well. And then the deficit and debt is huge, and we know that. You and I know that we have a slightly different view of where the economy is going. I think manufacturing is returning to the United States. And if you look at Detroit selling cars at a 15 million unit annual rate, remarkable given that we were at 9 million units in 2009, 17 million in 2007. We're having an energy boom, 600,000 jobs, crude oil production is 18% higher today than it was in 2008. Our dependence on foreign oil has gone from 60% in 2005 to 46% today. Largest producer of natural gas in the world, and we're a net refiner of exporter of refined energy products for the first time in 62 years. Average salary in Silicon Valley, $100,000. If we have engines of economic growth like this, can it change the current account balance? Can it help with the way we finance our deficit? Can it create a 50s, 60s style economy that is entirely unexpected today?
Well, it can help certainly with the balance of payments. The problem is none of those sectors you just mentioned are very labor intensive. You look at manufacturing coming back, I'm the first to celebrate it, but you go into a modern factory and you see robotics and numerically controlled machine tools, the old assembly line is gone. These are not labor-intensive places. There are very few technicians. You go into the energy fields, North Dakota, there are not that many people who are, relatively speaking, in the energy sector, and there won't be. You go to Silicon Valley, it's great, but most of the new jobs that are being created in the American economy today are retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation, low wage. We've been losing high wage jobs. We're creating more low wage jobs. So if people don't have money in their pockets to turn around and spend to create more jobs, we are going to be up against a very anemic recovery, unfortunately, for a long time. I wish I could be as Pollyannish.
Oh. Nice. No, how about just optimistic?
I didn't say you. I was going to say Pollyanna as Simpson. No, I wish I could be upbeat about it, and I try to be, but this has been going on too long. It's a very, very difficult thing to come out of.
You weren't going to be pinched and riven, were you? Pinched and riven.
No, I'd avoid
all
that.
All drawn up darkness.
No,
clouds.
I'm a source of light.
which should be evident from our conversation. I would, at this point, like to take a moment, because we are going to take your questions that I have next to me. But before we go on to that and continue our line of questioning with our two esteemed guests, I do want to take a moment to recognize some of the people who are on our question review team, the people responsible who are for selecting your questions that will be presented to our speakers momentarily. Please hold your applause until I introduce the entire group, and they include the following: Jeannie Evers, Night City editor for the Monterey County Herald; Fran Gaver, attorney with Leach & Walker; Donna Jones, senior reporter at the Santa Cruz Sentinel, and if you would stand, by the way, if you don't mind; Doug McKnight, reporter for KAZU Radio;
and Jeff Mitchell, who was the senior writer for Salinas, California. And so we thank them and would like to acknowledge them for their contributions to the season. Also tonight, we have with us a group of students representing those who attended this afternoon's student program, which the three of us can attest was a quite vibrant and energetic exchange with our students. Good. At this time, I'd like to ask all of the students in attendance to stand, please, if you would, those of you who are there today. Please remain standing. You know how to take an order, okay? Until I finish recognizing each of the schools present. There are 15 schools represented this evening, and the students are from Al Salo High School, Cabrillo College, California Maritime Academy, California State University, Monterey Bay, the Defense Language Institute, Harbor High School, Marina High School, Monterey Institute for International Studies, Monterey High School, Naval Postgraduate School, San Jose State University, Santa Clara University, Seaside High School, Stevenson School, and the University of California, Santa Cruz. Now, this afternoon, we had a wonderful turnout with the students. The student program, by the way, is possible only because of the generous support of the lecture series sponsors, Mrs. Panetta and the Panetta Institute Board of Directors. Very grateful for the support they've received that allows students from high schools, colleges, and universities from throughout the Central Coast and Northern California to participate. So please give these sponsors a hand as well. And now the fun begins. We are going to ask questions of our guests that you yourselves provided. And so I will begin, Secretary Reich, with you, over my own personal objections at the moment. You've been a little snarky with me tonight.
No, I have nothing but admiration for your Pollyannish approach.
What one policy would you change to impact the economy in a positive way?
I think although I do share Alan Simpson's concern about the deficit, I think education is the core of our economy. I would invest in early childhood education in a big, big way. I think that is where the most important feedback is.
Senator. Since currently Republicans and Democrats cannot seem to agree on how to restructure Medicare and Social Security, do you see these programs going away in the future? What compromises are necessary to ensure they both survive when it's time, in this instance, for my retirement? You want to raise your hand, whoever asked that question?
Well, they will survive. The programs will survive. But if you read our report, there are certain things that you do. First of all, you go to a defined contribution system instead of a defined benefit, which is breaking people down. You get rid of first dollar coverage. Who won't go into the hospital and know you don't have to pay a penny? So you get rid of this first dollar coverage, and you say if you get sick and you go, you got up to $500. You're $500 deductible. You're in for the first $500. And then after that, you come down to 20%, and after $7,500, you're on the house. You don't have to pay anything. You do that. You affluence test. You have to affluence test these beneficiaries, and they say, well, isn't that totally un-American? Well, it's totally un-American to go broke too with a system that was built to take care of the little guy. Okay, and you do these things, you do everything we have in that report, and you can sustain the system. We said you can't let it grow over 1% of GDP a year. It's pretty generous. We cut $400 billion out of it, which is you can get out of it. You got to quit the Medicaid gimmickry between the state governments so they can then say, well, I got hit more money back there in the old home ground. And the state says, we had to give you more money, so then you get your money to make that up from the feds. And that's a great gimmick on Medicaid. So you can save any system if you do something that is now instead of doing nothing now. If you do nothing now with Social Security, then you're going to waddle up to the window in 2036 and get a check for 23% less, and not one soul has challenged or can challenge that figure.
Madness. Correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm remembering our discussion of last year. If I recall correctly, you and Erskine said that if you means test both Social Security and Medicare, and you raise the retirement and eligibility ages by a couple of years, you would increase or improve the solvency, extend the solvency of Social Security by 75 years and Medicare by 85 years. Are those the right numbers?
Yeah, you do other things, and you can still take care of the little person. We said you give the lower 20% of the people in Social Security, give them 125% of poverty, give the people from 80 to 85 an extra kick called the senior thing, change the CPI across the board in the United States to a more market-based economy, change the wages subject to the tax to $190,000 instead of $106,800. Do these things, and you can save the system. But for heaven's sakes, the one that sticks in the craw of the AARP is that we would raise the retirement age to 68. And don't forget, Social Security doesn't have a damn thing to do with retirement. It was never a retirement system. It was an income supplement to take care of ditch diggers in the 30s or guys who were in the Civilian Conservation Corps. It was to give them 43% of the replacement rate for digging ditches when they couldn't work anymore. It hadn't a damn thing to do with retirement, and the life expectancy was 63, so the retirement age was set at 65.
Say that one more time.
You don't have to, but that's what it is. And it was never intended to handle disability insurance. That isn't structured for that, and DI will be gone in 4 years. Disability insurance is the most abused part of the Social Security system. What is your disability? I'm a drunk. Well, is that your disability? Well, they will put you into the disability insurance. This is nuts. And any time you talk like I do, you have to guard your home. let me tell you, I'm a veteran. Try this one. I was on active duty for a couple of years. Try this one. This is what Leon has to deal with. There are 2.2 million military retirees. I found one the other day I'd been looking for a long time. I said, where were you on active duty? They said, I never was. I was in the National Guard and the Reserves. If I'd have stayed another 8 years, I'd have been a military retiree. They have their own health care plan. The premium is $470 a year and no copay, and it takes care of all their dependents and costs $53 billion a year. And we're saying, we ought to affluence test, but because did that military retiree quit at 38 or 42 and pick up a COLA beginning then and go on up through? No, you have to do things like this. And when you do this stuff, you are accused of anything. Our professional veterans will drill your teeth. I'm a member of those groups, the VFW and the American Legion. They would like to blow up my house. But let me tell you.
And have the means to do it,
Just remember this. There are probably 24 million of us veterans, and maybe 3 million ever heard a live shot go past their head. And some of them never left Camp Beetle Bailey and don't know a mortar tube from either end. And they get every single benefit that a combat veteran gets. And I say, show me the combat veteran, combat theater, just pay the ticket. But for God's sake, a guy that served a year or less gets the same benefit, that is nuts.
All right.
And there is where you are. And Leon has to deal with that stuff.
Yeah, I know.
And he's doing it. And he's getting ripped. Yeah, he's getting ripped. And who's he getting ripped by? The VFW, the retired military officers, the American Legion. On and on and on. And it's just, when somebody tells me a horror story, I get to tell one on the other side. And that really irritates people. Like
Secretary Rush.
And especially you. Now, let me tell you what I told him the other day. Here's what we should do with the rich to stimulate the economy. Anybody with a net worth over $1 million, take everything they got over that. Every yacht, every aircraft, all 5 homes in the Bahamas and the Antigues or wherever they are, the shells.
Antigues?
Get them off, whatever they are.
It's a very small island.
And just take all that away from them. That will run the country for less than a year. So you can't tax your way out of this hole, you can't cut spending your way out of this hole, and you can't grow out of this hole. You got to hit people, and it's going to be painful. And if you don't want to do that, then, you know, pay me now or pay me later is the old ad, and that's where we are in this country.
Secretary Rush.
Just pour this on your head.
It's so uplifting to be here with Ron Simpson.
I'm just composing myself. I'll be with you in a minute.
Okay.
Given the current state of the economy in the United States, what sorts of triggers might lead to another great recession? Do you think we are out of the woods yet in terms of another big downturn?
I don't think we're out of the woods, and I think that the problems, there are 3 major problems. One, Europe is going into recession. They're into the austerity trap. I don't think we're going into an austerity trap, but the austerity trap is pretty clear. And that is when you start to cut your budget deficits and slow down your growth so much that your ratio of debt to total economy starts growing, then you're in deep, deep trouble. And when your people start marching in the streets, as we're seeing in Spain and Italy and also Greece, then you don't even have enough political stability to get your people to understand what needs to be done. So Europe is going into recession. Number 2, we've got a huge slowdown coming in China. And that means that all of the nations dependent on China's continued growth, and we're talking about Latin America and Australia and a lot of commodity producers are in trouble, which means a lot of American companies indirectly are in trouble. And number 3, we've got a problem of consumer demand here in the United States, and that we've talked about. Still, this recession continues for 90% of the country. Are we going to get out of it? Not anytime soon. We're going in the right direction. I don't want to spread the gloom and doom that has been spread over this audience tonight.
But the good news
is the direction, generally speaking, the direction is correct. It's just not fast enough, and we're not doing it quickly enough. We're not growing quickly enough. Unemployment is not coming down fast enough.
You saw how no one in this audience felt that we're in a recovery. You have folks like Nouriel Roubini, who's out there saying that we are heading into a second great recession.
Yes, if you think it's depressing tonight,
have Roubini here. Yeah, I know. And he's not the only one. There's Peter Schiff. There are a whole host of guys who appear with me on CNBC, talk elsewhere, who keep saying that 2008, 2009 was a warm-up act. For anyone who was involved in that experience, as intimately as some of us were, that was no warm-up act. That was either a curtain closer or March of 2009 was the end of that particular crisis. And so to say that we're going back in, as some people do, seems to me far too pessimistic.
I agree. I don't think we're going in, but the financial markets are still not where they should be. I don't know how many of you heard that the Dallas Federal Reserve Board, and the Dallas Fed is one of the most conservative banks in the entire Federal Reserve System. Yeah. Last week, they came out with a report recommending that the big banks on Wall Street be broken up. Now, this is the Dallas Fed, and they have had a lot of experience. They know what they went through, the savings and loan crisis. They know what banking crises really look like. At the same time, you've got the biggest banks on Wall Street still not adhering to the principle of the Volcker Rule, which is to separate commercial and investment banking, basically a kind of Glass-Steagall light.
Yep.
But they don't want to do it, and they're not doing it. So we've got a Wall Street that still hasn't learned its lesson. I'll add that to number four on my list of potential problems. I mean, why don't we resurrect the Glass-Steagall Act? Why didn't we do that?
I think we could have skipped Dodd-Frank entirely and just done Glass-Steagall, and it would have done wonders for the system.
The Volcker Rule is important, and they're all trying to kill it, and it comes from campaign contributions. Yeah. You go look and see where the campaign contributions are coming to get rid of the Volcker Rule, or else they've written regulations for it of 380 pages to invoke the Volcker Rule, which is, look, you do banking and you don't get to play around the other stuff. That's the Volcker Rule. It's a very difficult rule. I mean, that's it.
Now, by the same token, you have to admit that U.S. banks, one could argue, are significantly better capitalized today. They've been, again, stress-tested by the Federal Reserve to encounter a 50% stock market decline, another 30% down in real estate, and a recession in which the economy falls in excess of 8% in GDP terms. And they all pass with more capital than is necessary. So granted, one could argue about the implementation of this rule, but the banks are in far better shape than they were 3, 4, 5 years ago.
They are, but I was talking to a lead banker, an executive of one of the six major banks on the Wall Street last week, and I said, how exposed are you to the European banks?
And he said he didn't know.
And he said he did not know.
I know.
I said, wait, that does not inspire confidence. He said, I don't think there's a problem because I think we're insured. I said, insured? He said, oh, yes, credit default swaps.
Yes.
I said, you know, have you been alive over the past 5 years? I mean,
This is really true stuff.
No, this is true. If you think our banks are bad, the French still haven't written down their exposures from 2007 and 2008.
But our banks are totally entwined in derivatives with the French banks and the German banks. Everybody's face looks so distraught.
There's a gentleman opening his wrist.
This is an upbeat discussion and an upbeat evening.
Have a glass of water. There you are.
Senator Simpson, what's the difference between President Obama and potentially nominee Romney's economic plans for the future? Do you see, as yet, a difference stated in a material fashion?
They're both caught in the trap that the president got caught in the other day when he told about Russia. He said, if I get reelected, I'll be more flexible. And it's the same thing with Romney. To get through this campaign, he's had to tilt in ways. I thought the Republican Party of my party was this: government out of your lives, the precious right of privacy, and the right to be left alone. Well, then what the hell? What the hell are they messing around with contraception and abortion? I don't know anybody. I hate to see people clap for me because it means my message is being distorted. But what could be worse than having that to face in your own family as to abortion? It's got to be the most horrible thing I can imagine, but it's a deeply intimate and personal decision. And then gay lesbian issues. We are all human beings. We're all God's children. You don't have to get into the marriage issue. That's the flashpoint. But we're all human beings, gay lesbians. This is nuts. And our party is just throbbing around with all this junk, which has nothing to do with the economy, nothing to do with the future of America, everything to do with messing around in everybody's life. So, anyway.
Harriet? Ron? You know, let me just say, Senator Simpson, when I worked in government and you were in the Senate, you were considered to be a right-wing conservative Republican.
That's right.
In fact, I had to sneak out of my office. This is true. Because my staff, when I would say to them, I want to have lunch with Senator Simpson, they said, Simpson? If you do that, you haven't even had lunch with all of the Democratic senators. If you have lunch with this guy, your name is going to be mud. And so I snuck out one day. We had an illicit lunch together.
And my staff said, you're not going to visit with the Democratic Secretary of Labor, this guy Reich. I said, yes, I enjoy him. We're going to have a visit and talk about things. Man, I tell you, and it's 50 times worse right now.
It is so much worse because you would now be considered a moderate or left-wing Republican.
I probably couldn't get, if I could win a statewide election, but I couldn't get through the 62 members of the Central Committee because of my views on social issues.
And that's not even including all of the AARP assassins who are going to...
Yeah, well, the great thing, though, is he doesn't have to worry about being caught.
That's right. Don't forget Grover Norquist.
Yeah, Grover's out there, too. Let me ask you about something about this, though. I mean, over the last couple of years as I've come here, I've heard from veterans in Washington who say that, used in this example, if they're a Republican and a Democrat waiting for an elevator in Congress right now, they won't take it together. Where what you're talking about, however clandestine your meetings were, you had them. They're not even being had now. Is it possible to break that logjam? Who's going to provide the type of leadership that allows the types of compromises that we grew up with, whether it was Bob Dole and Ted Kennedy sitting together, whether it was Leon and Pete Domenici talking across the aisle? Where does that type of leadership come from, and who bridges that gap?
Well, first of all, let me say the public does not like this. All of the polls and all of the focus groups and everything the politicians are listening to tells them the public doesn't like this partisan bickering and this guy. And yet,
it's not even an adequate description anymore, is it?
It's much worse than that. Yeah. And yet, there's also the media. I was on a talk show with a conservative economist, and we were having a very good discussion. And in my earpiece came the producer during station break and said, be angrier. And I said, I don't want to be angrier. We're having a very good discussion. Why do I have to be angry? She said, because people are, they're moving through the channels. They're surfing through the channels so fast, they will stop only when they see a real fight. So you've got to be vicious and angry. I said, I don't want to be. She said, we're going to be back on the air in 10 seconds. Be angrier. And I lost my temper. But that's what we're up against. It is not just Congress. It is really a culture that is now, I think, rewarding a kind of surliness. And I don't know where that's coming from, except that there's so many people who are insecure about their jobs, worried and frustrated about where they are, that maybe
But this even predates
want to vent some of this.
You know, Senator, I mean, it's interesting. There is an echo chamber out there, and particularly, you know, and I've worked in cable news for quite a long time. People will tune to the channel that appeals to them most in some instances, or they will tune to the channel that appeals to them least so they can yell at the television and vent. And this is true. I mean, I've understood that in when they've done an audience breakdown of Bill O'Reilly's show, for instance, it's like 40% love him, 60% hate him, but they love screaming at the television set. There's a dynamic that's going on in the country with this echo chamber where at the extremes, the conversation, the dialogue is being had, and in the middle, very few people are galvanized to speak. They really, those who are setting the agenda are on the wings, and they're going out and watching what they want to watch and then regurgitating it in public. And I'm sure that does not help the process in Washington at all.
Well, it's impossible. And then you got the right-wingers and the left-wingers, but what you really have is people who couldn't legislate their way out of a paper bag, who are on the radio or the television. And their program consists of what they read in one of the 8 newspapers that was handed to them at 5 in the morning, which just get, they pick something out of there, and you can pick, you know, one every page to say, do you know what they did here, what they did here? These people are entertainers. They make $50 million a year off to you and me, and they don't add one single thing to the national debate that's important. And they wouldn't even know what a piece of legislation looked like or how to legislate. And I think that's a tragedy. I really do. And it's madness.
Come back to the budget issue for a second, and I get both of your takes on this because it's a question that some people feel is the silver bullet as far as budgeting goes, and others disagree wildly. Constitutional amendment to balance the budget.
Secretary Reich, is that what we actually need?
Now, that would be outright lunacy, because that would mean we could not run deficits when we had to stimulate the economy, and we could not run surpluses when we actually needed to dampen the economy. We couldn't raise taxes when we wanted to dampen the economy and slow it down. We couldn't cut taxes when we needed to accelerate the economy. It would actually eliminate the possibility of any fiscal policy to even out the business cycle. And that would be, again, just simply crazy.
And not only that, it's impossible. It comes too late. It takes two-thirds of the vote of the House. You couldn't get two-thirds for anything in the House or the Senate, nothing. Then you had to go with two-thirds of the states, and that may take 6 to 8 years. And brothers and sisters, we don't have 6 to 8 years, because the people who will call the shots here don't give a damn about who's president or who a Democrat is or who a Republican is. They care about their money. And when the markets react, and it could come in 6 months, it could come in 6 weeks, it could come in 6 years. Erskine thinks it will come within 2 years. I think it will be closer than that after they see the dysfunctional behavior coming December 31st about the Bush tax cut, the sequester, the Social Security, the AARP, Grover, and the pressure where they get a call in the middle of the night, you do this and you will lose election next time. They have worshipped the god of re-election. And furthermore, they don't have to worry, a lot of them, because they come from a district where the primary is the election. And then they're home free to just go about their way. And that's what you have to face in this situation.
So you think we're facing a crisis December 31st?
I think that Bernanke has said that is the fiscal cliff. And the real cliff could be is if they do all the things that I would want to do, get rid of the brush tax cuts, get rid of sequester, kick the Social Security payroll tax back, and flood the system with $6 trillion overnight. And it could be the worst thing you could do. See, if it took us years to get in, it's going to take us months and years to get out. And so if you can just give them the blend, you don't have to have my name on it, or look at old Alice Rivlin or Domenici or the Gang of Six or the Gang of Eight. Thoughtful people are working on this baby. And we're going to be fine, we won't disappear, but we won't be number one. And the markets will pull the chain. And at that point, inflation will go up, interest rates will go up, and the guy that gets hurt the most is the little guy. And I say it again and again and again. And that's the person you're hearing about day and night. The president's getting particularly bad. He gave a speech for the Associated Press the other day. I mean, all he needed was violin music in the background and a symphony. It was about the poor and the this and the downtrodden, on and on. What Republicans, and he really nails Ryan.
I thought it was a pretty good speech. I want to find out.
I think, what time?
I want to find
it?
Out from our esteemed senator, what would you think about a capital budget in which you took, and I mean a family. Regards an ocean cruise. Spending on an ocean cruise is completely different from investing in a college education for the kid and the family. They're both expenditures, but one really is a capital expenditure in terms of building the future of the family, and the other is an ocean cruise that might be nice now, but you can't really afford. But the federal budget does not distinguish between investments, genuine investments, and current expenditures. And part of current expenditures are all kinds of stuff that we might like to do, or various things, the safety nets we might like to have. But what about having a real capital budget for education, for infrastructure, for basic R&D, monitored in such a way that you can't have it airtight, but you try to get rid of some of the mere bridges to nowhere. You say that's not real infrastructure. You have a priority set of infrastructure projects that you've got
to
do.
How about two-year budgeting? Add that into it. Mm-hmm. Where you have two-year budgeting instead of one-year budgeting.
Well, I'll add that into it, too. Yes.
I think you're absolutely correct. You can't, as Erskine uses this marvelous one, the Nobel Prize winner, I've learned everything from Erskine. He said, I think his name was Ernst Rutherford, and the money ran out from the Nobel Prize. He said, the money is gone. We're going to have to start thinking. That's where your country is. The money's gone. And I hate to say this, but you know how we got here? Because people ask this all the time. You know what you did? You sent us to Congress to bring home the bacon. Go get the railroad, go get the airport, go get the YMCA, go get the dam, go get the road. Go forth and get it, or we'll defeat you for re-election. You become the pack horse. You get the money for education. You get it for this educational system. You get it, get it, get it. And we were sent to Washington to do that, to bring home the bacon, and the pig is dead. There's no more bacon to bring home. And this is the painful part of where we are right now. Do you remember the flogging they went through? They got rid of earmarks. Wasn't that a flagellation? Yeah. And do you know what those were? $16 billion. That's a sparrow belch. And you know... No, no. And do you know why the highway bill is really hung up? Because everybody that got their neck broken on earmarks and went and gave the pledge and did their beautiful work have stuck it back into that highway bill. And the 83 guys who went to Congress as the Tea Party guys, they didn't go to limit government, they went to stop it. And that's not, and they're not goofy. These people are not, I've talked to the national head guy. He said, how can we help you? But let me tell you, all they're trying to do is stuff it back in. And when a guy says, I'm only going to run one term because, by God, I'm going to do something, well, then what the hell does he have a pack for? I mean, if you ran for one term, you don't need a pack. You should go and sacrifice yourself on the great altar and come home.
Can I?
With lumps all over your head, for God's sake.
I want to go back to the sparrow belch for just a moment. Because, and the dead pig, because I think we're forgetting something. And that is that when Leon Panetta, he had just come from being Bill Clinton's OMB director, and then he was the chief of staff in the White House. I was there in the administration. Bill Clinton was president. You were in the Senate. We balanced the budget.
Yep.
All right? We balanced the budget.
I thought Newt Gingrich did that.
No, Newt Gingrich did not do it.
All right.
Thank you. We balanced the budget despite Newt Gingrich, and then we had a surplus for a number of years. I mean, this is not impossible. This can be done.
All right. This leads me to a great audience question, Bob, for you. Do you understand why President Obama put the Simpson-Bowles report in the drawer? Why do you throw these guys under the bus?
Well, I can't speak for President Obama, but I can tell you that he does not think he threw them under the bus. He thinks, genuinely, and I haven't talked to him directly about this, I've talked to people around him about it. He thinks that he's moving as fast as he can in the direction of Simpson-Bowles. He says that the budget that he submitted, we're talking about President Obama, doesn't cut domestic discretionary spending as much as Simpson-Bowles, but cuts the military spending more than Simpson-Bowles. In fact, he says $600 billion more than Simpson-Bowles. Now, I haven't gone through the numbers, but he is at least still holding the flag of Simpson-Bowles.
He does. Yeah. And he's using Gulf War savings in there, and that's already been worked in. That's a billion, that's a big number. And there's no need to do a gimmick on that. But Erskine visited with him for an hour and 45 minutes. I haven't told Bob. Just the two of them. This was about 3 weeks ago. And I think the essence of the discussion was Erskine said first, let me tell you why you're irritated at Al and I, and then we'll tell you why we're irritated at you. And that started a good conversation. But Erskine said, you know, this president knows what he has to do. And he will do it in his own incremental way. And don't forget, he can go to the electorate and say, wait a minute, Bowles Simpson was 4 trillion in 10 years, I was 4 trillion in 12. But it's not specific. But he has laid his groundwork in that speech at George Washington, where he ripped Ryan. And I was sitting next to Sperling, your pal, and he just drilled Ryan's teeth. It was a crude thing, and we went into the White House.
That's the excellent speech we were talking about.
Bob, let me ask you a follow-up question on that, and take this in the flippant manner in which it's delivered. You said you haven't gone through the president's budget numbers, but you went through Paul Ryan's.
No, Paul Ryan has almost no budget numbers at all. All Paul Ryan has is he's got a $4.6 trillion tax cut. He says that tax cut is completely paid for, but he doesn't provide any indications of how, and then he's got some bottom line numbers on how much he's going to cut out of domestic discretionary and Medicare and Medicaid. That's all he's given. But those numbers
But he says he's going to get it from tax loopholes and, you know, gimmicks.
That's what he says, if you say you're going to get it from closing tax loopholes, and you don't say, and then you say, when the press says to you, well, what tax loopholes are you going to close? You say, oh, that's really up to the tax committees.
But the president hasn't been specific either, so, I mean, it's the same thing.
Well, the president has been specific in terms of saying that with regard to anybody whose income is over $250,000 a year, he's going to limit many of those deductions to the 28%.
Why are we stuck on the $250,000 number still? For anybody who lives in this part of the country, who lives in New York, who lives in Chicago, who lives in Miami, who lives in Los Angeles, who lives in San Francisco, who lives in Washington, $250,000 is a lot of money, to be sure. But in a lot of these places, 90% of Americans live in cities today, not on farms. It's not being rich. It's having an okay life in a lot of places. An apartment in Manhattan costs $1 million for one bedroom. You're not going to have a lot of kids with a one-bedroom apartment. Why are they still fixated on that number?
Because we're talking about marginal taxes. That is, only the income over $250,000 would be limited. Secondly, this is the top 2%, the richest 2% of Americans. Thirdly, most of them are Democrats. They're on the coasts. They're in New York. They're on the West Coast. We're not really talking about hitting, or he is not talking about hitting people who are violently opposed to being hit.
You can't. The president could never have accepted what we did. He would have been torn to bits by his base, who said, do you realize you're talking about entitlement reform and senior citizens? You got to be nuts. This is how we're going to get back into power. And if he had said he was for it, the Republicans in the House would have automatically been against it. Just like that. I mean, unanimously. Because that's anything he throws out, they're against, and anything they throw out, Boehmer throws out, he's against.
All right. Let me ask a couple of final questions. We've got about 4 minutes left. And I think we tried it this way last year. Senator, I'll start with you. If we reconvene 12 months from today, we'll have had a presidential election here. We'll have had a lame duck session of Congress. Will the world, our world, be vastly different 12 months from today or not?
It will be very different a year from now. I don't know where, but I think that whoever is elected or reelected will drift back toward the center. The worst one word that has happened to America is Iowa. Because in January, 50,000 people gather in the middle of the night who are attracted.
They are coming for you, by the way. I don't know if you hear that.
Here they come now. I was on federal probation for shooting mailboxes. And then I slugged a cop in Laramie. So these years have never ended. But let me tell you, Iowa in January, where they attract the left-wing kookos and the right-wing kookos to commit, and a group of human beings, which is one-third of the people in Wyoming who vote. We vote about 160,000 people in Wyoming. 56,000 people gather in Iowa in the middle of the night, and Gore himself, who I've always had trouble with, He said, how the hell could you have voted for ethanol? He said, I had to get through Iowa.
All right, real,
and
okay.
To get through Iowa, you got to prostitute yourself to the biggest extreme of the Democrat Party and the biggest extreme of the Republican Party.
Are we going to be better off or worse off 12 months from now?
Well, I think we'd be better off a year from now.
Bob.
I think we will be better off. I think unemployment will not be dramatically changed. It'll be about 7.7%. People will feel a little bit more comfortable, and they'll be happy that Obama was reelected.
Oh. Senator, would you agree?
What's this smell? You got booze in there.
Senator.
Don't forget this one. People don't vote for anybody. They vote against. And I think as long as Obama keeps pandering like he's doing, if you saw something, they said he's going to speak tonight at 7, nobody would show up because he speaks every day.
At 7.
After his pollsters have told him just exactly what to say. And I will think that they're going to say, I don't know who his opponent is, but I'm tired of him. Now
all right,
watch out.
Senator.
Oh, this is going to
I'm literally
be...
coming up on a hard break. Do you think Romney's going to win?
Only if people say that they just are tired of Obama and they'll vote against Obama, so Romney will win. He can't win on a one-to-one, you know, in the basis of what he's got to wade through. When you ask him, what are you going to do out the economy if you've got $9 worth of spending cuts and $1 worth of revenue and 9 arms shot up like robots? You
Bob, I have 20 there. Seconds left. You
well,
think
I,
the president
I,
will win?
I think the president will win. But I think that it's the kind of integrity and public service represented by this man that really is going to win over the long term.
On that note. Please thank Alan Simpson, Senator Alan Simpson, former Secretary, Labor Secretary Robert Reich. That is all the time we have. With an issue this complex, discussion moves obviously very quickly. On behalf of the Panetta Institute, I'd like to thank our guests for joining us this evening and thank each and every one of you for your continued and very generous support. Thank you and good night.